Voice, voice of the International, African Revolution.
I shall leave you. And all I can say is, let's learn to live and love one another. Bless you very much. Thank you and good night.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And love brought me back, DJ Rogers. DJ Rogers, one of the problems I had when I was in California, I went to San Diego many times, and DJ Rogers has a church, a chech in San Diego, California, and I always wanted to hear Mr. Rogers preach, believe it or not, but I never made that. But he did a song called Love Brought Me Back, and DJ Rogers is one of the pride and joys of Los Angeles, California. He was kicked off of a recording session with Bobby Womack, DJ Rogers, and Glenn Goins, the brother, the Mothership Connection brother that used to be with Parliament Funkadelic. Because Bobby Womack said, this is the Bobby Womack show, and DJ Rogers and Glenn Goins was, they can sing, as you can see. But someone said, at the risk of seeming ridiculous, let me say that the true revolutionary is guided by a great feeling of love. It is impossible to think of a genuine revolutionary lacking this quality. And this is a quote, not from Mahatma Gandhi, not from Martin Luther King, but from Ernesto Che Guevara. And I would like to thank Afia Wangaza for producing and hosting last week's Diasporic Music, and did a tremendous job. And we will call on Afia again. And I have two very terrible things to report. My good comrade and friend, Didon Kimathi, has joined the ancestors. And Didon Kimathi was a host at KPFK in Los Angeles, and he allowed me to host his show or appear on his show many, many, many times. And I spent much time with him when I was in Southern California, and Didon will be missed. And also, we lost a young man by the name of Rick Holmes. Rick Holmes was one of my idols, and Rick Holmes and Roy Ayers did a song called Remember to Remember, and he also did an album with Nat Adderley. Rick Holmes was born in, I think, in Knoxville, Tennessee, and he just passed away. He used to work at a clothing store in Los Angeles across the street from Los Angeles City College, Ziegler and Ziegler's, and we used to hang out and just listen to him talk. He was a rapper. And I would like to thank O'Malley Ishatella and Archie Shep I'd like to thank Chairman O'Malley Ishatella for giving me the space to do Diasporic Music, and I would also like to thank Archie Shep for giving me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And we're going to have Melinda Francis on, and also we're going to have William Sales. And Bill Sales is going to be talking about the track and field situation in 2015. But right now, we're going to listen to some music from some juju music from King Sonia Day. And I wanted to dedicate this to my grandmother, who had two Yoruba names. Although she was born in Louisiana, her name was Ola May. And this is Jafumi from King Sonny Ade. Yeah.
banjo li mado ajoku mola umani papa tundi rajoku mo iwo areni la mo ai mo wo areni akubalu kubani turi buti ukoko lotu bitu ile elo mi amo buti ukoko lotu bitu ile elo mi amo
before she answered. One panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her. Comprehension, she was beyond trying to hold on to life. She thought she lived with no arm, that's what it felt like. Got to the hospital, eyes held tight. They moved the room to room, she could tell by the light. Handcuffed tight to the bed, through her skin they bit. With guns to her head, every word she got hit. Who shot the trooper, they asked her. Put mace in her eyes, threatened to blast her. Her mind raced till things got still. Opened her eyes, realized she's next to her best friend who got killed. She got chills if they told her that's what she would be next. Hurt mixed with anger, survival was a reflex. They lied and denied visits from a lawyer. But she was building as they tried to destroy her. If it wasn't for this German nurse, they would have served the worst. I read the sister's story, knew that it deserved a verse. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free, so dig it, y'all. Talkies crackling, not saying where they taking her. Though she kinda knew what made the ride peaceful was the trees and the sky was blue. Arrived to Middlesex prison about 6 in the morning. Uneasy as they pushed her to the second floor in a cell. One cot, no window, face of hell. Put in the basement of a prison with all males and the smell of misery. Seedless toilets and centipedes. She exercised, paint, and began to read. 2 years in a hole, her soul grew weak. Away from people so long she forgot how to speak. She discovered freedom is an unspoken sound. And a wall is a wall and can be broken down. Found peace in the panther she went on trial with. One of the brothers, she had a child with the foulness. They would feed her, hoping she'd lose her seed. Held tight, knowing the fight would live through the sea. In need of a doctor, from her stomach she'd bleed. Out of this situation, a girl was to see. Separated from her, left to mother the revolution. And lactate to attack hate, cause federal estate was built for a black fate. Her emptiness was filled with beatings and court dates. They fabricated cases, hoping one would stick. It says she robbed places that didn't exist. In the midst of threats on her life and being caged with Aryan whites. Through dark halls of hate, she carried the light. I wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could
be free. Yeah, I often wonder what would happen if that would have been me. All of this just so we could be free, so dig it, people. Grandmother would bring news that she had had a dream. Her dreams always meant what they needed them to mean. What made them real was the action in between. She dreamt that her Asada was free in their own house in Queens. The fact that they always came true was the theme. Asada had been convicted of a murder she couldn't have done. Medical evidence shown she couldn't have shot the gun. It's time for her to see the sun from the other side. Time for a daughter to be by her mother's side. Time for this beautiful woman to become soft again. Time for her to breathe and not be told how or when. She untangled the chains and escaped the pain. She broke out of prison, I could never explain. And even to this day, they try to get to her, but she's free with political asylum in Cuba.
Freedom. I'll be honest with you. I know a whole lot more about what freedom isn't than about what it is. Because I've never been free. I can only share my vision with you for the future about what freedom is. The way I see it, freedom is the right to grow. It's the right to blossom. Freedom is the right to be yourself, to be who you are, to be who you want to be, to do what you want to do.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Woo, 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 woo. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on a tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. And I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies are having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world.
Power 96 FM Radio is on its way to St. Petersburg, Florida, the only black-owned revolutionary radio station in our community. This will be our radio, serving our African communities, addressing our issues and concerns, speaking truth to power. Join us on Sunday, September 20th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a live stream coverage of our kickoff fundraiser on uhurunews.com and uhururadio.com. Our roundtable panel discussion on the importance of independent black radio, hosted by Ron Bob Semple, includes New York City Assemblyman Charles Barron, Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford, and the African People's Socialist Party Chairman O'Malley Ishitella. Join our live studio audience at the Uhuru House, 1245 18th Avenue South in St. Petersburg, Florida. That's the September 20th kickoff fundraiser for Black Power 96 Low Power FM station in St. Petersburg, Florida. Join us on Sunday, September 20th, live stream coverage on uhurunews.com and uhururadio.com. Black Power 96, your black-owned radio station.
96.3 FM Black Power.
This is a project of the African People's Defense and Education Fund.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We were listening to the music of Lauryn Hill. Lauryn Hill doing a tribute to Nina Simone. There's a song called Feeling Good. We also heard from Common. He did a song called A Song for Afata. And Common is, I guess he's conflicted between being Hollywood and being Common. And he is, that song right there, A Song for Afata, is a great contribution to the struggle, and I guess he's trying to make a greater contribution now to Hollywood, but that's here nor there. And we're going to be speaking with Melinda Francis pretty soon, but first we have on the line William W. Sales, Jr., the author of From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Organization of Afro-American Unity. But we're not going to be talking about Malcolm. We're going to be talking about track and field. Now, Kenya has come out on top of the overall medal count in World Athletic Championships in Beijing for the first time. They won 7 gold medals and Kenya also won 6 silver and 3 bronze medals with Jamaica. Jamaica came in second, and the U.S. came in third. And I wanted to get to William Sales. What are your thoughts on the world championships. I know you ran track yourself and yeah. followed track and field closely. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that many people in the United States were very much disappointed in the performance of American athletes at the recent world championships. But one has to recognize that there is a rest of the world, and they have a whole lot of talent which is now being systematically developed. And that's reflected in the medal take in Beijing. And I don't think we'll ever see a time again where American athletes will simply dominate these championships, whether they be world championships or Olympic championships. So I'm looking forward to a similar outcome in Rio next summer.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kenya, we used to always joke about the Africans from the Western Hemisphere would take all the medals from 100 meters to the 400 meters, and Africans in the West would run out of gas, and the East Africans would take over. Do you have any theories on why African people in the Western Hemisphere do so well in the sprints? I mean, if you look at the 100 meters, for example, Jamaica, Trinidad, United States dominate that. But for the first time in my life, I actually saw a Chinese in the finals of the Olympics. He actually has gone under 10 seconds. And that's, to me, that blew my mind.
Yeah. Well, recently, there's been kind of a resurrection of a kind of a neo-racist explanation for the dominance in the short events of people of African descent. But we've seen people in the literature talking about a special ability to sprint or people who are of West African descent. I always chuckle at this because how do you know someone's of West African descent? You mean you look at them? You see, that in and of itself is racism, because it says the superficial physical characteristics in some way reflect, inner essences of people. So that you look at Carl Lewis without doing any, genealogical research, and then you say that, he's obviously of West African descent, and I guess when you get right, he looks like he is, right? I don't know whether he has European relatives. If he's a typical African-American, he probably has some European genes in his gene pool. I don't know whether the African genes are the genes that make him fast, or the European genes, or only the African genes that are of West African derivation as opposed to the African genes that are of Central African derivation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know? The funny thing is, there used to be a time when Black people were not notable in the distance events, that European racists would say that's a result of the fact that they were not genetically predisposed to have stamina. Then, when Africans from East Africa begin to excel, these same people come up with racist notions that there's some kind of particular genetic predisposition of East Africans to excel. What that does is to negate the very hard work and systematic training regimes that have been developed by people of African descent to achieve. That is, if you want to understand, for instance, the success of Jamaicans in sprinting, then you have to look at the system that was developed over a number of decades by Jamaicans, by ex-Jamaican Olympic champions like Herb McKinley, and Dr. George Roden, among others, to build up a network all the way from primary school, all the way up through the university and the club system in Jamaica, to nurture a Jamaican talent. Right? That doesn't mean that they're not people who are predisposed to be fast, but that gene probably is found in many different people in many different parts of the world. But the training regimens are not systematically distributed all over the world. And therefore, the Jamaicans show a special ability in this regard. One could make the same argument for Trinidad, and you take a small country like the Bermudas that has maybe just about 500,000 people, and they systematically develop top flight 400-meter runners. So I think you have to look at some other things. One last thing I'll mention on that. A friend of mine, an Ethiopian, used to always laugh. He says, everybody think Ethiopians are really fast in distance. He said, most of us can't run particularly fast. He says, most of the distance runners in Ethiopia come from one village, most of the champions. And the same can be said of Kenyans. Distance running is not a phenomenon common of all Kenyans, that is, excelling in distance running. It's particularly located among a number of ethnic groups that are grouped in the Rift Valley area, in the highlands associated with it. So that's just some of my kind of reactions to these notions. Why do black people do A, B, C, and D? You know what I mean?
Let me say this. Gerald Horn has pointed out that in the Western Hemisphere, we are not only of white African descent, but, with some of us from Congo, some of us are from East Africa in terms of the gene pool. Has there been a lot of, I think it's Chris Tucker can trace his roots to Congo. And his brother used to sing with Shalimar. He's light-skinned, but it's really irrelevant. I think he could trace his roots to Cape Verde. And, I mean, you know, what I'm saying is that the whole question of all African people in the Western Hemisphere being from West Africa is not necessarily true.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And even if you deal with the internal roots, you know, that brought people down to the coast, some of those trade, roots associated with the internal slave trade in Africa were hundreds, if not thousands of miles long. So someone may have embarked from a port in West Africa. That didn't mean they came from West Africa. So, but, you know, when you really get deeply into the whole genetic explanation and associated with a concept which is sociological more than scientific, you kind of get into difficulty. In fact, someone wrote an article, and they were talking about Jesse Owens. And this is in the days when you had people doing all these measurements to determine what was a black person as opposed to what was a white person. And people, you know, who wanted to explain Jesse Owens' speed and the fact that he was black. Well, this commentator said, well, you know, according to all these anthropometric measurements, Jesse Owens is more like a white man than a black man. So, But, I'll give you one last thing here, too, Dorman. Take the decathlon. Is there a mixed race gene? Because we have Daley Thompson, right?
Right.
I think a Nigerian father and a Scottish mother. And then we got Dan O'Brien, an African-American father and a Finnish mother. And then we move from there to Ashton Eaton, right?
Right.
A white mother and an African-American father. I mean, what's going on here? it can get to be very funny after a while. You know what I mean?
Well, I kind of follow the 400 meters, and for the first time, was a South African won the 400 meters, and I was personally pulling for Karani James out of Grenada, but he came in third. Yeah. I think a brother from the States came in second in South Africa.
Yeah, Sean Merritt. Yeah. All those brothers were flying. They were all flying, man. Karani James came in third, and he ran something like 43.74. Merritt ran 43.65, and then Wade Van Niekerk ran 43.48. Now, you know that's flying.
How do you attribute that to what kind of training do the South Africans have at the moment?
Well, I think, you know, Van Niekerk's example is important. Here's a guy that showed talent from a young age. all right? And then some professional coaches and agents got a team together and a program together to help him, you know, develop into an international star. These people these types, these agents and professional coaches, they go all around the world looking for talent. And so you may find somebody who comes from a third world country, but may have a first world team working with them. Do you know what I mean? And Van Niekerk developed very, very quickly. You know, he has an interesting story because his mother was a championship athlete in South Africa, and she supported the anti-apartheid struggle and paid the penalty in terms of losing the opportunity to participate in the Olympics and certain kind of international competitions. But she's now able to see her son victorious as a world champion. And that was one of the interesting stories with Van Niekerk. But this guy is really fast. And he's probably the first person since, what's his name, Jeremy Warner, who's a Euro-American from Texas.
Yeah, from Texas, serious, right.
Yeah, who has a serious chance to break Michael Johnson's record, which has stood since 1999, 43-18. So we're all looking to see what Van Niekerk can do because he has quick leg speed. He can run around 19-8 or so. Maybe even less than 19.8 at 200 meters. And then, you know, running 43.48, he's being relatively young. When he gets up around 29 to 30 years old, what is this guy going to be doing?
Go ahead. I cut you off. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that that all those things about Van Niekerk should not minimize the possibility that Merritt or James is very much still in the picture. In fact, a couple of days ago, they all met up again in Zurich, Switzerland, and this time around, Merritt won.
Merritt? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, you've been to Cuba. Your daughter studied in Cuba now. I was very, very disappointed in the Cubans' performance, and it looks as if Cuba's having problems in athletics. Is that because of the blockade has finally hit them in that area? Because, you know, I know they when it comes to boxing, they're still number one in the world, but in terms of the overall track and field and the whole athletics, you know, I'm looking for Cuba to be right up there with the rest of the world.
Well, Cuba is still strong in track and field in the short events and the jumps. They took two gold medals, one in the women's pole vault, and the other, I think, was in the discus throw, which wasn't expected. But what we've seen, top-flight Cuban athletes, several hurdlers and what have you, they're athletes just like the baseball players, you know? Their track and field athletes are feeling the pull of other countries and the ability to, you know, really earn relatively high incomes relative to Cuba. So you'll find all over the world ex-Cuban athletes. One, for instance, did very well in the 400-meter hurdles. You find them in different countries, Turkey, Sudan, Italy, one of the best European 400-meter runners. Labania Grinot is an ex-Cuban. So they always have that problem of losing their best athletes. But the Cuban athletic system is still strong in terms of its role in the health of the whole population. So regardless of the performance of his championship athletes, throughout Cuban society, there are ways that people can systematically participate in a multiplicity of athletics. And I think maybe ultimately that's even more important than whether they're winning or losing gold medals.
Well, let me ask you this. Could you talk about the phenomenon of watching a track and field meet on your television when you see an African person running for Qatar or running for for Hong Kong or running for Switzerland. What's that all? Could you explain that?
Well, you know, there's several things that immediately come to mind in responding to that question. One is when you see a Kenyan, right? He used to have one of those Rift Valley names, and he's suddenly running with a Muslim name.
He's Abu.
And you're trying to figure out, who is this guy? Because you know that he was good, right, as a Kenyan, and you're trying to figure out which one of these Kenyans is this guy who's now running for Bahrain with another name. And sometimes you'll have the guy running for Bahrain with a Muslim name, and his brother is running for Kenya with his given African name.
Right.
Trying to figure out what the hell is going on here, you know. But man, they're paying some of these people phenomenal money for poor people. $2,000 a month for the rest of your life. People haven't, you know, got any money. And then some of the people you're seeing in Europe, you're seeing Ethiopians at the top of the 1,500 meters, for instance, in Sweden and in Holland. And they're there because they went there initially to be trained, you know, by people who were based there and stayed there and decided that, you know, they would take out citizenship. In some instances, people go to other countries and take out citizenship because as good as they are, they wouldn't make the world championship or Olympic teams in Kenya or Ethiopia. And so we see, just like any other valuable product, we see Africa exporting athletic talent to the rest of the world.
Right.
Of course, there's a backflow in the sense that many of these people are sending a whole lot of money home, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a weird phenomenon. I mean, there's a guy named, I don't want to mess up his name, so I'll hold off. But when you look up and you see an Ethiopian running for Kazakhstan, you know, or a long jumper, you know, long jumping for Russia, it's Africa. I mean, it's the weirdest sensation. Or you see the Swiss team running with, you know, at least half the sprint relay team is composed of people of African descent. I don't mean just that they're you know, African descent, but they actually come from African families, they have African names, you know. It's kind of interesting. In fact, before, you know, we hooked up on the show here, I didn't get a chance to complete it, but I was trying to count the number of people of African descent who won gold at this recent world championship compared to the total number of gold medals given out. And when you do that, and I know I haven't finished the count yet, you'll find that people of African descent have overwhelmingly dominated the meet. Even take something like the distances. Well, you look for the Kenyans, but the number one male distance runner right now is Mo Farah, a person who was born in Eritrea who's been since the age of 8 or so a citizen of England. Right? And Mo is kicking everybody's butt. You know? So if it isn't a Kenyan or Ethiopian, right, there's a good possibility it might be a transplanted East African.
Right.
Who will prevail. So, you know, what can you do? And even now, if it's not a Caribbean or a U.S. African-American in a short race, right, that it may be, you know, if you look at the fast cats from Europe, I mean, you look at the French team, they're 4x1 is nothing but people of African descent.
Well, let's talk about
England.
Canada. We had DeAndre DeGrasse.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Came tied for third with another brother from St. Petersburg, Florida. Brummel,
yeah.
I think. Was it Brummel?
Brummel, yeah. These two young guys are the wave of the future. Lightning fast, sub-10 second, sub-20 second at 200 meters, getting a whole lot of international experience. Yeah. The grass seems to be slightly better than Brummel. Although Brummel, start-wise and form-wise, it's much faster, but DeGrasse, he's got this kind of top-end speed, as we call it, you know, sort of like Tyson Gay. You know, when somebody gets rolling, they're not out the blocks fast. When they get rolling, man, it's over. And DeGrasse has great top-end speed, you know, and he's got people thinking back to the, you know, the glory days of Canadian sprinting, around, you know, the middle 90s, when Dale and all those cats were, you know, dominating not only the individual events, but the relay.
Bernie Sorrell from Haiti and Donovan Bailey and,
Now that's right.
Right.
And Canada got third in the 4x1 at the recent World Championships. You know, the U.S. got chucked. And China
And the
got
China
the
came in second. Now, that was, that was strange. That was strange.
Well, the Chinese had some good foot speed, but the thing about China and Japan is that they handle the stick, man. They take care of business.
That's very important, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in a relay, people don't realize what you want to do is make sure the stick is moving fast all the time. It's not just the foot speed. And see, with the U.S., even when they get it around, many times they have real fast runners, but they're slowing the stick down in the process of passing, and they're losing time. If you look at the tape of this last 4x1, the Chinese guy looks like he's starting about fifth or sixth place, right? But when he gets the stick, he's got so much speed built up. He didn't have to slow down that much to pick up that stick. He's flying past some people before they can build back up to their top-end speed. So, you know, that's a technique. And what a number of commentators have been noting that is that you have to have a team that practices all the time.
All the time, right? That's Jamaica's one of Jamaica's strengths, I believe, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the U.S. is a joke. They have two camps. Right? I mean, there's 365 days in a year, and you have a couple camps, maybe last one week each, right? It was better if we picked four guys and told them, next August, you're going to be running the 4x1 in Rio, and every day from now till then, you're going to practice stick passing. Oh, my gosh, I think we'd break the world record by 2 seconds. You know, any four, you know, take our number 10 to 14. Don't have to take 1 through 4. Take the 10th fastest, the 14th fastest American sprinter, and have them work together for a whole year. Nobody would touch them.
This is the last question. You and Max Will Curtis Stanford Jr., a.k.a. Muhammad Ahmed, ran the relay together. Could you give me one example? And you were the anchor man. What did Max run?
Max's best race was 800 meters, what we called a half in the day because we were doing yards. And he ran 800. He did run some quarters also. Actually, we ran against each other and with each other. We went to different high schools, right, and competed against each other. But in the summers, and many times indoors, we ran together under the banner of the Philadelphia Pioneer Club. And so I had the chance of running with him and against him.
So
Max was good. He was good.
You were the anchor man. What did Max run on the relay?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember the meet when Max ran. Max didn't run the anchor. He ran one of the internal legs.
No, that's what I'm saying. Right? Max always told me that you were the anchor man.
Yeah, I ran anchor.
Right.
Yeah, I ran anchor.
He acknowledged you as the king in terms of
Let me put it this way. I could run a faster quarter than Max, and I was smart enough not to run against him in the 800. I wasn't going to step up in distance and give him a shot. You know what I mean?
All right. I'm speaking with Bill Sales, author of a book on Malcolm X. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I'm what you call a track and field fiend, but I recognize that the increasing commercialization of sport in the neoliberal era has taken a whole lot of away from our ability to enjoy it, our ability to believe in the athletes and to believe in the legitimacy of what we see in front of our eyes. And, you know, that's sad. But it's a sport that will never be like the big sports, football, baseball, you know, soccer and what have you. But it's a very good sport to participate in. I think none better. And what I really like about it is that you really, really become friends with the guys you compete against, you know, not later on in life, but right then, during the time that you compete against them. You know, you get to know them. It's not a kind of sport that promotes a kind of physical confrontation or a violent confrontation between people, but it's one where people really, really come to respect each other and the mutual struggle to, you know, to just go one better with your body than you went previously. And I hope we never lose that.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. We'll definitely call on you again, and I'm hoping that people will go to their bookstores and buy From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Organization for American Unity. I hope they'll get your copy of that.
Okay, thanks, Norman. I'm going to go down here and see if Venus is beating this girl up.
All right.
Okay, take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye. All right. And we have been speaking with William W. Sales, Jr., author of Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And Diasporic Music continues on Huru Radio.
You're listening to HuruRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru Radio.
Black power in black community.
And we're calling on all Africans. We recognize that as a people, we have tremendous skills in our community.
Informative.
So we've got to take all the skills that we've learned. You know, we've got to take all of our energy, and we've got to find a way to contribute to making sure that African people have a future.
No degrading lyrics.
It's the future. One, two, y'all. Africa, it's the future. One, two, Africa, it's the future. Yeah, there ain't no future unless we build it now.
Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Nanga Def. And Nanga Def is Wolof. And that's Wolof. And I was taught that by Yusu Endur, who's coming to Toronto, I guess in November, and I hope to see him. And stay tuned. We're going to be speaking with Linda Francis shortly. But right now, we're getting ready to pay tribute to Jackson, Mississippi's own Cassandra Wilson. And Cassandra Wilson is paying tribute to Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the sun.
strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
You are listening to Dire Sport Music on Uhura Radio. We are paying tribute to Jackson, Mississippi's own Cassandra Wilson. And I remember seeing Cassandra Wilson many years ago here in Toronto, Canada. And she was with a young man by the name of Freddie Waits. Freddie Waits was a great drummer from Jackson, Mississippi. I think Freddie Waits was born in Jackson, and I think he went to Detroit, but and he was in the tradition of Max Roach and Art Blakey and Alvin Jones. He was a pounder. He was a great, powerful drummer. And Cassandra Wilson was outstanding at that time, but that was many years ago, and she is continue to make her contribution. And right now, we're going to listen to the philosophy and opinions of Cassandra Wilson. This is her some of her thoughts on politics, culture, music, and so on and so forth. This is Cassandra Wilson.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Pace Report. I'm Brian Pace, reporting live here at the Blue Note here in New York City. For well over 25 years, vocalist Cassandra Wilson has been able to uniquely put her own imprint on how she interprets rock, soul, blues, spirituals, and great folk music. The beautiful thing about the sister is that, one, she never wants her music fans to place her in this box. Tonight we're going to talk about how she's been able to incorporate her unique blend of vocalism, as well as talk about her upbringing in Jackson, Mississippi, and also how today's musicians and music fans don't have an appreciation for the great American songbook as well as great American roots music.
The birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
First of all, I want to ask your comments about this thing that Nicholas Payton is doing as far as his comments about BAM, because I believe what he is saying validates what you've been doing your whole entire career. They've been trying to put you as this jazz vocalist, and you're just a musician. You're a vocalist.
Well, first of all, I really support Nicholas Payton and what he's doing right now. I really think that it's time someone stood up and said, you know, the things that he's saying. And I really was happy to see Gary Bartz and the, you know, the comment that he made about the, it's, you know, the plantation. You know, it's very similar to that. There is a system here in place, and, you know, artists are pigeonholed. You know, and we're supposed to stay inside of just this one space inside of music, and that's not realistic. You know, we have a continuum of music.
I think what's interesting about your career is that you are still evolving as a vocalist, because there's still ground that you're covering as far as vocal as well as the material that you're singing.
Yes. The one thing that I've learned is that change is constant. You have to always change. And it's always been a part of me. You know, people have asked me to say, you know, just sit still for a minute and do these standards. And that's never been me. So, you know, it's always been about the art pushing forward. It has to. If it doesn't, it will die.
I understand that. Being from Mississippi, and I spent a lot of time in Mississippi, that you understand the whole folklore of black music as far as the blues and spiritual. Explain how that has crept into your musical vernacular.
Well, it's not only the obvious things, as you said, that, you know, in Mississippi we're exposed to gospel music, funk music, rock and roll music. But let's be honest. Country music is also something that we can say grows out of that tradition. And certainly rock and roll does. We know that for a fact. in fact, all of American popular music, anything that you can name, anybody that you can look at, any star, any icon that is performing American popular music has to look to Mississippi. That's the foundation. That's where it begins, and that's where it's fertilized.
Going to Greenwood, Mississippi, and actually looking at Robert Johnson's graveyard, or just going down to Indianola, Mississippi, where B.B. King and his museum is. I mean, the blues trail is very important, and one of the things that I am really disappointed in, especially how people have covered our music, blues is like a forgotten trademark of our roots.
It is. But I think, you know, it's interesting is the black audiences are always ready for the next trend. You know, we're constantly moving forward as a people. So we tend to abandon, you know, the old forms. And I understand the reasoning behind that, but I think it's really important to always pay tribute to the ancestors. You know, even if you're going to do something that stems from that tradition, you really have to take the time, you know, to go to places like that and to remember in your thoughts and in the music that you perform the debt that you owe to your ancestors.
And there's a political connection to a lot of the civil rights movement stems from our roots music. And one thing that you have done throughout your career is, I mean, when I listen to you and I have seen you perform over the years, you carry so much of Nina, you carry so much of Odetta, you carry so much of Harry Belafonte with the fact that our roots are in the song.
Yeah, well, that's a part of the Mississippi legacy, I believe, as well. You know, the spirituals, a lot of the spirituals are really code. You know, that's the music that they used for liberation. You know, people tend to associate it strictly with the church, but and it is associated with the church and, of course, worship and that aspect of Christianity. But it acted as a code, you know, to help the slaves to either get on the Underground Railroad and go up north to get out of slavery. And that part of the tradition is really not discussed enough, I think. It's how we've encoded, you know, the spirituals and what what some of the lyrics actually mean.
You know, I want to hit on something that you just said about the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read this, but you know that the Underground Railroad in Cincinnati is about to close because of their lack of funding. And I've noticed that the arts in general right now, we are in a state of emergency right now because it seems like people become kind of comatose. We're like, we don't care about the music that we're listening to. We don't care about going to the polls, voting anymore. It seems like we're at this complacent stage right now. What is happening right now with people as a culture?
Which people do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about people in general. I might as well say people in general right now.
I think it's difficult to say because different people have different, you know, agendas or different platforms or different thought processes that they're going through. I can only speak for my community. I can't speak for, you know, what's happening at large. But I think we're experiencing kind of a spiritual transition right now. You know, I think that we are beginning to come into the realization of the importance of supporting the homegrown community programs, you know, whatever is going to uplift the community. I think that we are beginning to pay more attention to that. And so it's going to look like things are a little bit scattered out there because there is a transition going on. 2012 transition. Yeah.
Where do you see the state of roots music, American black music, going forward right now? Because Nicholas and some other musicians, and even me as a journalist going forward with this, we have something that we have in our hands that we have to pass the baton to. What are you going to do?
Well, I think we're almost prepared to board the mothership. I think that we have all of the elements that we need to take to go to the next level of consciousness. I think that the music is you know, especially after hip-hop and everything that was happening with hip-hop, I think now we have like a full picture, like 360 degrees of what the black experience is. And so now it's just about going out there and expressing it and keeping a close tie with the ancestors and with the community.
That'll do it again for another edition of the Pace Report, reporting live here at the Blue Note here in New York City. I'd like to personally thank Ms. Cassandra Wilson for her time, as well as the staff and management here at the Blue Note. As always, please visit my website, www.thepacereport.com, for my weekly column as well as my past segments. Until next time, remember, if it's in the groove, it'll make you move. Until next time, peace.
Birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. Oh, young man, you were only waiting for this moment to rise. Blackbird singing in the dead.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we just heard Cassandra Wilson, and she was being interviewed by she was being interviewed on the Pace Report, and that was about 12 minutes long, and that'll give you some idea of how Cassandra Wilson was thinking about 3 years ago. And she has a new album out, paying tribute to Billie Holiday. And we are going to listen to Cassandra Wilson, and she pays tribute to, well, she's going to do some Canadian and some Jamaican content. The Weight, Robbie Robertson is a Canadian, and he was with The Band, and The Band, of course, backed up that guy, Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan went to Israel, and I think we should boycott Bob Dylan until he straightened that situation out. But Cassandra Wilson did the song The Weight, and she also did the Redemption song, which was made famous by Robert Nesta Marley and the Wailers. But let's listen to The Weight by Cassandra Wilson.
I was feeling about half past eight. I just needed some place where I could lay my head. I said, hey, mister, can you tell me where a girl might find a bed? He just grinned and shook his head. No, it's all he said. Oh, take a load off, Annie. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Annie. And you put the load right on. Up my bag, when looking for a place to hide, when I saw a Carmen and the devil, they was walking side by side. Said, hey Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny. And you put the load right on. Miss Moses, there's nothing you can say. It's just old Luke. Luke's waiting on the judgment day. Well, Luke, my friend, what about young Annalee? He said, do me a favor, son, and won't you stay and keep Annalee company? Take a look. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny. And you put the load right on. And he caught me in a fog. He said, I will fix your rack if you take Jack, my dog. I said, wait a minute, Chester, you know I'm a peaceful woman. He said, that's okay, but won't you feed him when you can? No. Take a load off. Cannonball, to take me on down the line. My bag is sinking low, and I do believe it's time to get back to Miss Fanny. You know she's the only one who sent me here with her regards for you. Take a load off, Fanny. Oh, pirates, yes, they rob us. Sold I to the merchant ships minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? It's all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. Only ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear of nuclear energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom?
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And we just finished listening to Cassandra Wilson. She did Bob Marley's Redemption Song. And she also did the Wait. That's the First Nation guy by the name of Robbie Robertson. He put that song together. And The Wait is one of my favorite songs, and Cassandra Wilson hasn't been to Toronto in a minute. I hope she comes back. I would like to check her out and see what she's up to. And joining us on the line from Toronto, Canada, is Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly DocuVexen. And she's a radio producer at DocuVexen Radio, radio host at Artists in the City, programmer and radio host at Saturday Morning Live. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here.
I guess we had a number of things we wanted to talk about today. We wanted to talk about the situation in Haiti, your film in Haiti. We also wanted to talk about some archival work. I guess that's proper English that we're doing together. And I guess we also wanted to talk about, you know, Danny Glover has been working on a film on Haiti, and, you know, he's having some financial problems. But I just was reminded of the fact that the Black Panther film, I think it was done with $9 million. The Morio Van Peebles film, $9 million was budget. But one of the things that the Hollywood put in front of them was that they wanted Tom Cruise and or Bridget Fonda to be a part of it, to, you know, get a Caucasian flavor in order to, for the box office. So what are your thoughts on that whole situation, Danny Glover, as well as no, that Panther film, or did you see that?
I haven't seen it yet, but I did not know that. But I know how basically, you know, you sell a film, And, you know, when you go to certain, like, you know, financiers or whatever, you have to sort of pitch into their framework. So if you're pitching a film to Hollywood studios, they have their, you know, bankable stars, like you're kind of going into that system. So that doesn't really surprise me at all. And I mean, you're actually going into that sort of studio system that has, you know, been around since, you know, the inception of Hollywood. So,
right.
Yeah. And yeah, there has been, I've been following, the Danny Glover, saga of, the Haitian Revolution film that he's trying to produce and finance. And it's been a long time. He's been trying to make this film for a long time. And, you know, I heard that, you know, he went to Hollywood and wasn't able to sell it. And then, you know, Europe, went to Europe. And also, you know, and the things that he got was like, well, there's no white heroes in the Haitian Revolution story. So, so anyway, but the last thing I heard, and I actually got like a article, he was given $18 million from Venezuela in 2007.
Right.
So that was the last time I heard. And I mean, that was a while ago and a lot's happened since then. So, I don't know. I think, I don't know if they had started production or, but that was the last thing I've heard and I haven't heard anything since. But they had the whole class, the whole cast, it was all casted. It was, I believe, you know, most staff was in it, like a few big actors, they had signed on to the film. And so, yeah, and it says actually it wasn't just Danny Glover, but it was also Harry Belafonte was involved as well. So, So I don't know. I would have to follow up on where the status of that film is.
Right.
And if it's just on the shelf or it's still in motion, they're still looking for financing. I don't know where that is. Right. But, I believe they were just they were ready to shoot. Like they had casted the film and all that stuff. So I don't know what happened, but I mean, since, you know, the death of Chavez, I'm sure that complicated a lot. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, the Black Jacobin was the first time I heard of the Haitian Revolution was reading the Black Jacobins. And I think that the Black Jacobin was put together in 1934 or 1938. And it was a great book about Toussaint, Dessalines, and Christophe. And one of the criticisms that I've heard, you know, in recent years is that, you know, some people want to, or some people are saying that Dessalines was really the leader of the Haitian Revolution because he led the revolution to the end. And, you know, Toussaint got tricked and went to prison. And the other criticism is that women were left out of that narrative. Now you're doing a documentary on Haiti, and could you talk about what role women will play in your doc? And you know, what are your thoughts on how women have been portrayed in the literature about the Haitian Revolution?
Okay, so that's like a huge question. I think to start of how my entry into Haiti, and I've been making this film for about 4 years. I started it in 2010, and it's specifically around, you know, Haitian diaspora's role within the reconstruction after the earthquake, but yet it's sort of bigger than that. It's sort of being able to rebuild despite the tons of barriers that Haitians face every day. So I've gone there twice. So I went in 2011 for a month, and this year I was able to go for three months. So I've in that time, sort of following various projects, specifically in, you know, mostly around building and reconstruction. And then it's kind of expanded into, you know, agriculture and food security, just from the different projects that I've kind of interacted with. So now to go back to your story, women actually had, you know, a big role within the revolution. One of the historians that I actually interview, her name is Baino Bello, and she has actually a book, and she talks about it, specifically the role of women within in the revolution. There was even women units within the revolution. So they have a big role. There's a lot of disinformation about various leaders within in the thing. And from what I learned, and from the people in Haiti, they're pretty much like, for example, Toussaint Louverture actually means the opener, Dessalines, so he opened the way for the revolution, and then, you know, Dessalines kind of took over. So it's not oppositional, but, you know, Western gaze, they're always put together, like pit against each other, but, you know.
So when what are you working on in terms of, you talked about an archival work that you're doing. Could you talk about that?
So basically, in my work, in any work that I do, it's a lot about sort of community embedded storytelling and film and media. So with the production of the Haiti film, which is called The Diaspora Travels Haiti, and people go to WordPress and they will find it, and they could actually follow the progress of the production. So not only is there going to be a film, but there's going to be ongoing archive of the different work that's being done on the grassroots in Haiti. And to go back to connect it to the work that I'm doing with you, Norman, is that you were like pretty much the first person that interviewed me on my first trip. And if you recall, it was basically the day after CKLN basically was pulled off the air. So I guess from that time. We've worked ever since, and I think it's also the archival work that I want to continue to do is, you know, creating ongoing platforms for community media, because it seems to me that there's like a closing off of space of community journalism, community art, community, there's just an attack on community, the community voice in general. So that's what I'm looking at, you know, doing, not only with my own work, but also with other like-minded people that I work with. So that's you know, basically what you know, we hopefully we can continue to do with this, the the amount of information that Saturday Morning Live has done over the past 30 years.
Now, when we think about the Canadian situation, be it First Nation, be it African, be it working class, how do you think the Canada stands when it comes to documenting the African First Nations and working class history of this country?
Well, there's a lot of barriers to it. I mean, when I think about, like, I've been involved with community radio since 1996, and it's kind of closed down. It's kind of, you know, closing down. I don't know if other people would agree. But yeah, there's like sort of new platforms that are popping up. So it's how do we kind of sort of keep what we, you know, the space that we already have, but also when things kind of get, you know, shut down, how do we transition into new platforms? And I don't have any answers to that yet. So it's just to keep on working at, you know, keeping community voice there. Because, I mean, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know. I don't have any answers. I just hope that we can kind of, you know, actually work on that and build on that.
Well, it seems as if everyone has moved or is being forced to go into internet radio. So I guess the question is, how can we build internet radio into a stronger force? Because I know a lot of people that don't listen to internet radio for whatever reason. It's so much easier to turn on a car radio or turn on a radio than some people are listening to. Either not listening to radio or only listening to internet radio. So I guess the question is, how can we promote internet radio? Yes.
And yeah, not just keeping networks within progressive radio, and how do we kind of sort of build on a community front, because I find like a lot of stuff is done in silos, and how do we kind of sort of support everybody else's work as well, right? So it's because it feels to me that, you know, community media is being fragmented on a very fast rate. So yeah, there's these new, you know, platforms, but at the same time, it kind of gets lost in a sea of in the amount of internet radio that's popping up. So how do we create sort of a point of reference where people can go and get the news that they need? So, yeah.
Well, there. Cut you off. Go ahead.
No.
There recently we did two shows on CHRY FM in Toronto, which is going to take a new direction. I mean, they're on the dial, and I guess they're going to stay on the dial. But they are going to change their format. Now, they at one time had a format where they had spoken word music from many communities, African, the Sikh. I mean, I shouldn't say, I don't know about Sikh, but all voices, many voices in this area. Now they're going to go, I think, urban, and I think that they're going to probably play more reggae, say, than 98.7, because 98.7 plays a mixture of music, great music, but their spoken word is weak. So what is the current situation with the battle at CHRY?
Well, I believe they have rebranded, so and they rebranded into Vibe, you know, Vibe 105.5, and they have been broadcasting, and yeah, they've kind of moved into a new format, you know, switching things into different segments, and so and there was sort of a move to you know, kind of clean house kind of thing of people who, you know, don't agree or with the rebranding. And there has been questions around, you know, transparency and how that was, that those decisions have been made. And that is still kind of on the table. And I believe that a lot of the old programmers are still kind of moving towards that and kind of questioning that. So, and I think that's kind of been on hold because, you know, students technically at York University are the only ones who can actually question that because they're the owners of the station. So the move is that, you know, in the new year, school has just started, so there'll be some organizing on campus to actually kind of make moves of, you know, basically questioning the transparency of the decisions that were made at the station to rebrand. So that's still ongoing. So we'll see what happens with that. And there is, you know, if people want more information, there is like a Facebook page. You can go to Save CHRY and get more information and updates on around that. But yes, so we'll see what happens with that. I think it's more right now, like sort of getting those questions answered. About you know, how these decisions got made, and if so, you know, was it transparent? Was it legal? Was it did they, you know, inform students that the way that they should have, kind of thing? So I think that's where that is at. But yeah, Vibe 105 has been, you know, they've been operating throughout the summer, and we'll see what happens and. that's ongoing.
Now, you, how can people, you want funding, or not necessarily funding, but in terms of how can people help you with funding for the film you're doing on Haiti? Have you set up a plan
yeah,
for that?
Yeah, people can, follow my work in general. People can go to the blog's site, and we have an ongoing crowdsourcing, you know, page that people can also go to and donate that way. And then as we go in the production, there's various events people could come to get updates with the production and the projects that I'm following. You know, various like screenings. There's like, you know, we usually have art shows with our photography. So, people can go to, the diaspora travels haiti.wordpress.com. And you can get connected to the page, and the work. People can actually, you know, actually just email me directly. My email is docuvixenfilm@gmail.com. And then you could get connected with all the projects. And also, if people want to actually connect with the Saturday Morning Live blogspot, they can go to saturdaymorningliveradio.wordpress.com. and get connected to their show. We have been on hiatus for a while, but you know, we continue to work on the back end of trying to digitize like the library. So, but people could connect directly to that project as well.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
No. Thanks for having me on the show, Norman.
All right. So we'll, I guess you'll be back again, and we will, see you in the whirlwind. And yeah. I would like to thank Lisa Watkins, Watson, pardon me. I'm thinking about my good friend Watkins, Bill Watkins, who passed away, but Lisa Watson. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to thank her for teching today, and thank William Sales for his interview, and go out and support the music of Cassandra Wilson, and we will see everyone in the whirlwind. Take care.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. People can...